from the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. This is Wayne Pond with Soundings, Conversations with Scholars and Visitors at the National Humanities Center. At the time of his death in 1961, Ernest Hemingway was, for many literary observers, a burned-out case whose artistic reputation had declined since the 1940s and 50s. But today, according to one literary historian, the artistic reputation of Ernest Hemingway is secure. That's the view of Joseph Flora, a professor at the University of North Carolina and a recent visitor at the National Humanities Center. Joseph Flora is the author of Hemingway's Nick Adams, published in 1982, an analysis of Hemingway's literary alter ego. Joseph Flora's book on the Nick Adams stories is one of more than a dozen critical discussions of Hemingway's fiction and life that have appeared since 1979. Let's begin our conversation about Hemingway. Lately, a lot of people have been, mainly some women critics, have been saying some mean things about him. Maybe you could begin by telling me, before we talk about the Nick Adams stories, give me some background on that. Why would there be criticism coming from women literary critics about Ernest Hemingway?
I don't know that it's a systematic sort of criticism. I have friends whom I like a great deal who like to take little shots at Ernest and do that. I think he invites it in a way. It's easy to beat up on him, and he's been a good sport about many things, so they want to do that. And I think sometimes it's because they're not reading him.
Mm-hmm. Well, what do they see? What inspires the criticism?
Ernest is macho. Mm-hmm. Ernest is not sensitive to women and how women feel about things. Ernest presented women as playthings for a very tough masculine hero, didn't show them as thinking people. And I suppose there's some of that that goes on. I know there is from my friends. And I think that they overdo that just a little bit.
Do you think, Joe, that that is a weakness or a flaw, however you want to characterize it, that's inherent in Hemingway? Is it intrinsic in his fiction? Or, let me give you a third choice, does the criticism originate in attitudes of the 1980s compared with social attitudes of the 1930s and 40s?
Oh, I think it does reflect change social attitudes now. I think also in part that Hemingway, like other writers, I think of James Branch Cabell being another, feeling that there were important differences between men and women and the way they think about things, and that there is a kind of gulf or barrier, and I'll not write my novel from a woman's perspective. Now, Henry James would do that.
Yeah,
feel comfortable often portraying events from a woman's perspective. Hemingway did little of that. He had male protagonists, which is not to say that he never went into the psyche of his women. And I think even in the Nick Adams stories, we have some good evidence that he could see things from other points of view. But he was reticent about that as a fiction writer.
Well, let's move toward a discussion of the Nick Adams stories by Ernest Hemingway. When you read Hemingway's fiction, maybe you can consider this just as a general proposition, are you reading what Ernest Hemingway had to say about life and sex and death? Or how do you figure out who's doing the talking in a Hemingway story or novel?
That is a tough one in a way, because you know when you're reading a Nick Adams story that it is fiction and that Hemingway is being the writer who is interested as artist in his character.
Maybe that's what I'm asking you. How do you separate Hemingway as artist from Hemingway as person who lived from, what was it, 1899 to the early 1960s?
The man is gone.
Yeah.
And he's dead.
Mm-hmm.
The writing is still with us. Now, Nick Adams is based in many ways on Ernest Hemingway. But Nick is still, whatever age that he is in the story that I'm reading. And I can do that experience with Nick again and see how Nick is feeling, how mm-hmm. Nick is suffering, what Nick is thinking about things. For Hemingway, it's closed. Mm-hmm. We don't relive that moment except as he has preserved it in art, but for a fictional character.
Tell me then about Nick Adams. Why is it important that a general reader should know about Nick Adams, and what kind of, again, at a general level, what kind of an insight does that knowledge lend to a wider knowledge of Ernest Hemingway?
Nick is a special hero of Ernest Hemingway. We know more about his early years than we do of any of his other protagonists. Nick is a doctor's son. He should be geared toward a world of achieving in a sort of upper middle class way. But his father is a more complex man than would at first meet the eye. He has arranged in those late years of the 19th century and the early years of the 20th century that there is a retreat.
From what to what?
A retreat from the world of sociability, a world of Henry James, if you will, where his mother's music, education, and all of these things, important as they are, can be set aside for education of another sort.
Now, this sounds like something that young people went through in the 1960s. Is there any unexpected?
Sure, that's why there's all this this appeal for Hemingway has continued despite mm-hmm. certain criticisms of his view towards women, let's say, that you might get from some people. Sure, the lure of the frontier, the simpler country, the last good country, mm-hmm. the title of that Nick novel that he never finished, to find that place, to find that pocket mm-hmm. away from the pressures of civilization.
And this is where? Northern Michigan, right?
This is in the northern part of the lower peninsula. Mm-hmm. Sometimes people think those stories are taking place in the upper peninsula. They didn't need to go all the way to the upper peninsula to really get away. That's even more removed, and it is that removed in Big Two-Hearted River. That's the only story that takes place in the upper peninsula.
Well, tell me what happens to Nick Adams. What kind of experiences does he have? What sort of, to use a large word, what sorts of morals does he embody? What kinds of social values does he stand for?
It's interesting that you should use the word morals, because I think you have to think about that when you read Hemingway's fiction. At least I do. I think a lot of his light, dark imagery and so on make him seem to me a good companion of Nathaniel Hawthorne.
Uh-huh. Where there is much contrast between lightness and darkness.
Much contrast between lightness and darkness. Hemingway is attracted to a good deal of that same thing, the darkness of the human soul and mm-hmm. what can be in that soul. The light of the world. There's plenty of darkness there, and not often as much light as one might find in Hawthorne.
Do you find in Hemingway the same problem that you might have in Hawthorne, that the meaning of the two, that grayness that's so difficult to figure out, where you have so many complexities and choices that are difficult to assign motives to? And
sure, I do. I think Nick, one of the lines I take is an epigraph for my book is from The Last Good Country, where Nick thinks you should have been an Indian. Uh-huh. It would save you. It would have saved you a lot of trouble.
Is he speaking for Hemingway here? Is there any sort of direct one-to-one relationship in that sense? Is that what Hemingway himself hankered for?
I think Hemingway doubtless went through some of the same conflict mm-hmm. About that issue. Here's a man who, after all, did marry four times, mm-hmm. because he's looking for that hearth and home that Hawthorne celebrates so much. And at the same time, I should have been an Indian, go out to the wilderness, let it be simple the way it was on the American frontier. One of the little fragments that we got after Hemingway's death was crossing the Mississippi.
Mm-hmm.
A great symbolic touch about that action for Americans to be free.
Uh-huh.
But at the same time, you get Nick, as I think you also got Hemingway, pulling towards the hearth, the home, the celebration of simple things. And yet families can be very complex things.
How much do we know about Nick in the sense that when he begins and when he ends as a character? How old is he at both ends of the spectrum? And how much change occurs in him?
Well, we know he's 38. That's as old as Hemingway ever took him. And I think that's interesting. He never made Nick an old man, although he liked to portray old men as people with dignity. And he gave us some nice old men to think about. But Nick never got beyond 38. When, in his later years, Hemingway goes back to Nick, he goes back to a younger Nick.
Does Nick grow up in the story?
Oh, I think Nick grows up. I think Nick grows up. He's growing up for us all the way in the first book that has the many Nick Adams stories in our time. And he is growing up about women and about family in that book. We don't hear for a long time in this story, Cross-Country Snow, that Nick is married. He's just off with a friend. And suddenly we get surprised. Nick is not only married, but Helen is pregnant. And obviously that's going to tie Nick down, and he's had to battle a lot with that. And he tells his friend, I'm happy about it now.
I remember hearing once that Hemingway had said of one of his heroes, he was morose for some reason, and somebody asked him why. And the reason was that he just killed off one of his characters. How did Hemingway live with Nick? Did he say anything about that?
He didn't kill Nick off.
No.
And that got to be the ending for, after a certain point, even in the short stories, that was the end of stories, got to be somebody's death. Or else very soon you knew that death was coming.
But he didn't kill Nick.
But he never did that with Nick Adams.
You think I was too close to him?
I think in part, yes. You want to keep pushing me back towards the autobiographical, and in a way I think you can do that and see in Nick that character that in a very special sense is closest himself.
Joe, did Hemingway like being a writer? I remember hearing that he really didn't like it. He wanted to get it over with so he could reap the rewards and go off and hunt rhinoceros in Africa. Is that true?
I don't think that's true. I think he was
a really writer. Enjoyed the enterprise of writing.
It was hard work. I don't think he would ever deny it was hard work, but that's what he had to be. That's what he wanted to be. Thus, even Nick Adams is going to be a writer too.
Joe, tell me how you approached your study of Nick Adams. Did you just read the stories all the way through? How'd you figure out what you wanted to say and what you didn't want to say? How do you decide on what's important to present in a presentation of Nick Adams?
Well, I got the idea for writing a book about Nick Adams when the new material on Nick was published.
And how long ago was that?
1972. The Nick Adams stories are published, and they contain all this new Nick material, plus an arrangement of those stories in Philip Young's book that sort of threw me for a loop, because that wasn't the way that I'd thought Hemingway had wanted me to think Nick had grown up.
And what were you after in your study of Nick Adams? What did you want to summarize for me?
Well, I was interested in the method of those stories and how those stories differed amongst themselves, but I wanted also to see what sort of pattern there was, to see if Nick was changing as a character, if I could see him growing up and maturing, and how what the problems were with that Nick faced that might maybe think of this as a novel or a continuing work in progress.
Well, let's pause on your word patterns. Tell me about one story. Tell me about, or if you like, one experience in a story that might illustrate what Hemingway is doing with his character of Nick Adams.
Well, perhaps the best of the stories, although many of them I think are very fine, is The Big Two-Hearted River.
All right, what's that about?
Here you've got Nick Adams, who is perhaps 20, maybe younger, we don't know for sure, but the war is over, although the war is not mentioned in that, and suddenly you've got Nick in country that we haven't seen him in any of the other Nick stories, and that is the one story that's in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. And he's the only character in the story.
What happens to him?
Certain sense should say nothing happens to him.
Mm-hmm.
He goes fishing.
Mm-hmm.
He goes fishing.
But something happens in the story.
Something happens in the story.
What is
sure. Nick faces in that story his past. I was surprised to see how like that story is to that of his friend F. Scott Fitzgerald, Babylon Revisited.
Mm-hmm.
A story in which there's a lot of conversation, but you've got Charlie Wales in that story going back to Paris, the scene of triumphs and defeats,
mm-hmm.
when there's a lot of wreckage back there that Charlie Wales would like to salvage if he can.
All right, and how does that, what kind of a counterpart do you have in Nick's experience in the Big Two-Hearted River?
In the Big Two-Hearted River, you've got Nick going back to territory that is familiar to him, but it's not that social world of Fitzgerald. It's the world of nature. We'll get to where there isn't even a telephone pole there.
Mm-hmm.
There aren't going to be jets flying over as we would perhaps have if someone went up to that part of the world right now when Nick would be going there in the early years of the century. Getting away completely, and he's got to face the same ghosts. There are ghosts in both stories.
All right, be specific for me now. What are some of these lessons that he learns or ghosts that he faces?
Well, let's talk about ghosts. I don't like the word lesson so much. That sounds maybe a little bit too much like Hawthorne if we want to talk about lessons. but I do think there are ghosts in both stories.
Mm-hmm.
There are ghosts in both stories. And they're in both stories, the character wants to control them very carefully. And Charlie Wales has been an alcoholic. He's had to be in a sanitarium. Now everything's very programmed. He goes through Paris. He takes one drink a day, making a point of that. Everything is so very deliberate, very controlled.
Calculated. Mm-hmm.
He's not going to rush his sensations any. He wants to win some things. He wants to not be a loser. Nick is very much in that kind of situation in Big Two-Hearted River, except he's not going to be seeing real people. He is going to also control his goes. He wants to get good and tired. He wants to sleep. That's the middle of the story, by the way. And Hemingway just breaks it in the middle, part one, part two, where Nick sleeps. And sleep is something that is not easy for a lot of Hemingway heroes.
Mm-hmm.
And you get blessed sleep in the middle of that story. And that's because he's controlled the ghosts so well.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You're listening to a conversation about the short stories of Ernest Hemingway. My guest is Joseph Flora, a professor of English at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Joseph Flora is the author of Hemingway's Nick Adams, a discussion about Hemingway's fictional alter ego, published in 1982. In addition to his work on Hemingway, Joseph Flora has also written literary biographies about the Victorian Englishman William Ernest Henley and about the American writers Vardis Fisher and Frederick Manfred. The discussion for Soundings about Hemingway's Nick Adams resumes with comments from Joseph Flora about one notable Nick Adams story, a work entitled Big Two-Hearted River.
And if I may go back to the point of women,
mm-hmm.
That's part of the complexity. Hemingway said he was writing about war and didn't want to mention the war, but I think you can sense very much that that's true about women, too. At the end of the story, before Nick goes to sleep, one woman does come in. The one ghost is of his friend Hopkins, the blonde Venus. And Hopkins said when he met the real wife, or his real girl, that things would be different. And Nick thinks, yes, that was true. That's the only reference to women. You'll notice that even the fish that Nick catches are male. Hemingway makes a point of mentioning that those fish are male. Nick cleans them out. That would, of course, make a difference. Even the grasshoppers in there, hundreds of grasshoppers in that story. Any grasshopper is a he in the story. And that's a part of the complexity of that story, that when Nick thinks about women, mm-hmm. it's very limited and very controlled. Everything is simplified. Nick has to have everything simplified because women are complications.
Does he experience a transformation? Does he experience a growth here? What's the upshot of this story?
The upshot of the story is that he decides he can go on. It's a much more optimistic story than Babylon Revisited, because we aren't so sure that things are going to work out for Charlie Wales.
It's a decision about going ahead and living, is that right?
It's a decision about living, and a decision to know that while he has to go into complex things, he'll be able to do it.
Let's come back to the point that you raised about women, male grasshoppers, male fish. Was Hemingway afraid of women?
You might say he saw what, or feared what a woman might be able to do to him.
What was it? Power over him in the sexual sense? And
I don't
the
think it was
sense?
So much in the sexual sense, or if we think about it as a character, here it's certainly true of Nick, that Nick thinks about what his mother did to his father.
And what was that?
That she dominated. Mm-hmm. She removed freedom. She was a destroyer. That sense of being an Indian got taken away from one by a woman. And I think that's partly there, you see, in Big Two-Hearted River, when he's thinking about his friend Hopkins and the male camaraderie Hopkins has married.
Mm-hmm. Maybe it'll be difficult, Joe, to draw a one-by-one parallel or contrast, but what about Hemingway now and his treatment of women? Is there a counterpart or a divergence in Hemingway's own life that would accompany this story that you've just told me about Nick's treatment of women?
Sure. Hemingway's treatment of women had some guilt about it, and I think what we know about Hemingway, he was more reprehensible by far than Nick about it. I don't think that he was as charitable towards his own mother as he might have been. I think she grew to accept him and to understand him perhaps more than he ever did her.
How does Hemingway treat men? What are the best things in the men in Hemingway's fiction? What are the worst things?
But the worst things would be to be a phony.
Mm-hmm. To be weak.
To be but weak is, that's more complex than it might be. It doesn't mean just, it means being weak really in a moral sense. Mm-hmm. You've got to care about things. You care about land, and I think you also care about people. It's there. We don't really have any stories about Nick and his wife. That's a very secretive thing, and that's interesting. If you compare Nick and Hemingway with all of his complexities, there are some hints about that, but we don't get Nick following in all of that.
That he wouldn't have revealed that.
That he somehow protects Nick from full revelation as the worst side of himself, if I may put it that way, and on the spur of them, that may not be the best way, but another story that I don't treat, and people really haven't thought of it very much as a Nick story, is Hills Like White Elephants, where you've got the speaker who might be Nick, and you could see that as a parallel to the story where Nick mistreats Marjorie. And the girl is pregnant, and she wants to have the baby, and the male character does not. And he's the male character is a bit of a clod. Well, Hemingway knows that.
Uh-huh.
And we look at the story, and all of our sympathies are with her.
Mm-hmm.
But Hemingway doesn't let us know that one is Nick. Mm-hmm. And people haven't felt that was Nick in the same way they've felt the protagonist of The Light of the World is Nick.
Mm-hmm. Joe, you've been talking about Hemingway and his character Nick Adams at pretty much an individual, a personal level, whether you're assigning Nick as Nick or Nick as Hemingway. How does Hemingway or Nick reflect the larger American social scene at the time that he lives or that Hemingway created him? Is that important? Is there a social dimension to all of this?
Probably you might get it in Wine of Wyoming, which I think is a Nick Adams story, where Nick has come back to America There you have a not very happy situation with a wife, but the hero is never named there. But you do get some social criticism there. America and its prohibition, America and its downplaying, its mistreatment of Catholics. We're very sympathetic to the French and the Catholic people, as opposed to a sort of grim Protestantism that is there. And the sympathies of the hero and of the narrator of the story would be towards tradition, if I may get like Hawthorne again, you see, to look towards that old world and grandfather and the way things are in Europe that America has lost out. So you get that curious pull, I think, a contrast between the lure of tradition and the beauty of Europe and the wildness of the American frontier. That's one of the nice tensions, interesting tensions that probably many Americans experience.
Joe, tell me, what should people know about the Nick Adams stories and why they are important in the literary scene, particularly regarding Ernest Hemingway?
Well, I'm not going to tell anyone to read them to find out about Ernest Hemingway. I'm going to say read them because they're awfully good stories.
Just by themselves.
By themselves. You don't need to know a thing about Ernest Hemingway to read those stories and respond to those stories and to see the experimentation. If you look back, if I can go back to comparing Big Two-Hearted River with Fitzgerald's Babylon Revisited, you see how very adventurous Hemingway is in that story and the way he structures it, in which there is one character. Stories are about people and conflict, and certainly you need dialogue, almost none, about three or four lines there. And
would you say, Joe, that Hemingway is a creative writer? What does he do to American literature that had not necessarily been done beforehand and that really extends to us now?
He certainly is a creative writer. I think he changed the short story drastically. In this sense of you could leave things out, you could be silent about things, even the name of your protagonist if you wanted to.
Is this what you mean when you say that Hemingway makes his readers work?
I think he makes them work while he makes them enjoy. I think that's true. I think you get to enjoy, too.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to a discussion about the short stories of Ernest Hemingway, the American writer who lived from 1899 till 1961. My guest was Joseph Flora of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Joseph Flora is the author of Hemingway's Nick Adams, published in 1982, and co-editor of Southern Writers, a biographical dictionary, published in 1979. Next week on Soundings, a discussion about documentary editing and modern historical scholarship. The Soundings panelists will include documentary editors from the University of California at Los Angeles, Sotheby's Auction House, the Princeton University Press, and the National Historical Publications and Records Commission. Soundings would like to hear from you. Send your comments to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings is made possible by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Listen to Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center inviting you to join me this week for a conversation about the stories of Ernest Hemingway. My guest will be Joseph Flora of the University of North Carolina. Joseph Flora is the author of Hemingway's Nick Adams, a discussion about Hemingway's literary alter ego. At the time of his death in 1961, Hemingway's artistic reputation for many literary observers had declined, but today it's secure. Hemingway's Nick Adams stories account in part for this resurgence. Hemingway's Nick Adams, this week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center on this station.